On May 31, 2000, in Dallas, 6 months after the Mobil merger, Lee Raymond stood before the first annual meeting of ExxonMobil shareholders, an unruly gathering of religious leaders, environmentalists, and other dissidents who regularly used the meeting, which was required by law, to pressure Raymond over his corporation's public policies, particularly on the environment, alternative energy, and climate. One such activist had just accused Raymond of ridiculing those in the audience who disagreed with him. "I'm not ridiculing anybody," Raymond answered, "and I resent the assertion that I am. We have a difference of view. This is a democracy, and frankly, I'm not interested in being ridiculed." Another speaker demanded a long-term solution to global warming. Applause erupted. Raymond possessed no impulse to restrain himself on this subject. "If the data were compelling, I would change my view," he once said. 90% of the people thought the world was flat. No. Now Raymond went further than he had ever gone in locating his corporation's place in the global warming debate. "Mark, would you provide me a slide on the 17,000 scientists?" Raymond asked an aide. A slide duly flashed on a wide screen. It depicted a petition organized by anti-Kyoto campaigners and signed by thousands of scientists. The idea was to demonstrate that many respectable scientists doubted key aspects of the IPCC consensus about the likelihood of human contributions to global warming. The petition's credibility had already been undermined by testimony presented to Congress, demonstrating that its signatures included those of pop musicians such as the Spice Girls and James Brown. If Raymond knew about these problems, he did not care. "This is a petition signed by 17,000 scientists. There is no convincing scientific evidence that any release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will in the foreseeable future cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and disruption of the Earth's climate. So, contrary to the assertion that has just been made that everybody agrees, it looks like at least 17,000 scientists don't agree. My point is not that these 17,000 are right and you're wrong. Your point is you're right and I'm wrong. I'm not saying you're wrong. What I'm saying is there is a substantial difference of view in the scientific community as to what exactly is going on. We are not going to follow what is politically correct." He went on, "Mark, would you first give me the 3,000-year slide?" Another image flashed on the screen. It showed lines undulating on a graph. "That's the Earth's temperature, as best these scientists are able to estimate what it was for the past 3,000 years," Raymond continued. "It's been a long time since I went to graduate school, but if you just eyeball that, you could make a case statistically that, in fact, the temperature is going down. I'm not asserting that. Similarly, I reject the assertion that it's going up." The 2000 presidential campaign was a dead heat to the finish. Al Gore, concerned about winning coal states, muted his views about the dangers of global warming. The handful of quotations and policy statements George W. Bush offered on climate were rife with contradictions. Asked about global warming during a debate with Gore, he said that "it's an issue that needs to be taken very seriously." But he also suggested that some climate scientists were changing their opinion a little bit, without explaining himself further. Bush denounced the Kyoto Protocol as too harmful to industrialized countries like the United States, but his campaign also issued a policy document urging mandatory reductions of four major pollutants, including carbon dioxide. Bush's decision to name CO2 as a pollutant suggested that he might accept Kyoto's broad goals. After his inauguration, in addition to Vice President Cheney's Energy Policy Task Force, the president named a less publicized cabinet-level working group to review climate change science and policy. The members included Secretary of State Colin Powell, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, Commerce Secretary Don Evans, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, and Christine Todd Whitman, head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Cheney also took part. John Bridgeland, director of the White House's Domestic Policy Council, and Gary Edson, a deputy national security advisor, organized the process. They recruited a half dozen career climate scientists working in federal departments to move temporarily to the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next to the White House. They organized climate science and policy briefings for the new cabinet members.
"It was a heady time," recalled one of the participating scientists, Aristides Petrinos. "The potential was so great."
He and other career scientists summoned to the White House had concluded, on the basis of the evidence from the campaign and the transition, that Bush shared their sense of urgency about the need to control greenhouse gases. Because the president was a Republican with a background in the oil industry, Petrinos thought,
this was like when Richard Nixon went to China.
Bush could really be the one who would do something with respect to climate change. Petrinos and his colleagues delivered science lectures to the cabinet group at rotating sites, one time at State, the next at Agriculture, and so on. James Hansen of NASA delivered one private lecture. James Edmonds of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory gave another concerning the mix of policies and technologies that might be required to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations. During these sessions, which were unpublicized and closed to all but senior staff, Petrinos was impressed at how open-minded some of the cabinet members, such as Colin Powell and Don Evans, seemed to be. As the lectures went on, however, he also became concerned about the demeanor of Vice President Cheney. The scientists laid out vivid, illustrated accounts of the damage global warming could bring in the future: melting glaciers, rising sea levels, droughts, and severe storms. They offered specific forecasts about the impact global warming could have on public health and on the economy. One of the lecturing government scientists described the possibility of rising sea levels in lowland areas in Miami, South Florida, as Petrinos recalled it. Hearing this, Cheney shifted uncomfortably, Petrinos remembered. He looked like a raging bull. He got up, paced back and forth, then stood next to me, and I could sense that he was not a happy camper. Cheney remained silent. The vice president soon preempted the climate task force's work. Haley Barbour, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee who had become a lobbyist for a utility firm that stood to lose if greenhouse gases were regulated, urged Cheney in a March 1st memo to persuade Bush not to align with the eco-extremism of those who saw carbon dioxide as a pollutant. 2 weeks after Barbour's memo landed, Cheney arranged for Bush to sign a letter to Congress repudiating his campaign position about CO2, without so much as informing Christine Whitman, the new Environmental Protection Agency EPA chief, in advance. Whitman called Treasury Secretary O'Neill.
"Energy production is all that matters," she said. "Cheney couldn't have been clearer."
"We just gave away the environment," O'Neill replied.